Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. I'm Jamie with John. Happy April Fool's Day.
Man, this is a bad day. Like, there's so many times I just want to, like, I don't know, mess with people.
I'm so untrusting anyway that I just don't trust anything anybody does on April 1st.
My mother had a medical emergency that happened on an April 1st, and I refused to believe her because it was on April 1st. Until my father had to call and say, hey, this is not a joke. Your mom actually is in bad condition. She's fine now.
She's fine.
That will always be a way to remember April Fool's Day.
Yeah, I think there are some situations like that where you just have to believe it until you confirm. But in general, I just really don't trust people. We talked a little bit over on our Patreon episode that came out today about how I would love to do a prank episode on April 1st, but we're not bringing you that today. Maybe next year. We'll see.
We'll see. Today is definitely not a prank.
And our Patreon episode went up this week. It was Christopher Scarver, the guy who killed Jeffrey Dahmer and others, and kind of his backstory and what led him to prison in the first place. So that's a good one. If you've ever been interested in Patreon, go check that one out today. It's available now to all Patreon subscribers.
Absolutely. Just for the less than the price of a cup of coffee, you can have access to that and all of our other bonus episodes over on patreon.com.
It's always been less than a cup of coffee, but now you can subscribe for like a year for two cups of coffee.
Yeah.
Coffee's expensive. Everything's expensive.
It really is.
Except for us. Anyway, got another 5-star review that came in. This is from Chuck Myers, Inc., and it says, I've been listening to this show for years. As many listeners before have notated, I heard you first on Pod is Jericho. You know, we owe a lot to Chris Jericho. Nobody tell him I said that. I love your storytelling and how you never glorify the crime. You also keep it as clean as possible. And you can do that while talking about some horrendous acts. I would love to hear you all cover the Molly Corbett and Tom Martin's case in the murder of Molly's husband, Jason, in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Thanks for considering and keep up the great work. And I'm going to make that note on our list that is an actual list right now.
That's awesome, man. Thanks for the case recommendation. Tell me the guy's name again.
Chuck Myers, Inc. is the writer.
I will buy that stock. Thank you, Chuck. Appreciate it.
No, we appreciate that. And it is April Fool's, but no Fool's Day here, John. We've got an interesting one.
We sure do, man. Why don't you get the ball rolling today?
We're going to go back, not too long this time, just to 2009 on October 4th. 42-year-old pediatric nurse Kimberly Cates was putting her 11-year-old daughter, Jamie, to bed.
That's her daughter's?
It's a girl's name, I know.
I just had to point that out. I'm sorry.
Her husband, David, was away on business, so the two were home alone in their home in Mount Vernon, New Hampshire. At 3 a.m., Kimberly woke up to a dim flashlight shining in her face. And this is a super scary situation. The first thing she thought was that her daughter needed her, so she got out of bed and said, Jamie, is that you? The answer she got was being hit immediately. And then she took a blow from a machete. That machete would strike Kimberly 36 times. She was also brutally stabbed multiple times in the neck and the torso by a second person with another weapon.
This is probably one of the more violent ways I ever remember starting a podcast. Like, we're just jumping into it.
Yeah, machetes in the first section. We don't do that very often, but that's what this story is about.
Man, like, we've recently had some storms in our area, so I know, like, I've been woken up multiple times lately in the middle of the night, and it's always disorienting. I can't imagine being woke up and before I even realize like what is going on, this is happening to me like that. Crazy to even think about. So Jamie actually woke up from her mom's screams. So she got out of bed and she tried to run to see what was going on. So she was actually caught in the hallway by someone who was holding a knife. And this intruder stabbed this sweet girl 18 times in the chest. She also had stab wounds to her arms, her legs, and her back. At one point, Jamie fell into the arms of the attacker, and they threw the girl across the room into a glass door. The intruder spent a few more minutes looking for any valuable items, and then they ran off. Miraculously, Jamie had only been pretending to be dead when the intruders left. Once the coast was clear, the girl crawled into the kitchen and dialed 911. She could barely muster a whisper to the dispatcher that someone had killed her mother, and then she herself collapsed onto the floor.
What a heroic effort from an 11-year-old girl. I've got a couple 11-year-old kids in my house right now, and thinking about them doing this is just obviously worst nightmare. But how tough this girl was to be able to call for help. At 4 in the morning, first responders arrived at the home of Kimberly Cates. The officer who found little Jamie said that she was very covered in blood. Her left foot was missing, showing just how brutal and gory this attack was. She had a fractured jaw and a deep cut across her throat. However, she was still conscious and able to tell the officers everything that she remembered. In the bedroom, paramedics found Kimberly, and a call was placed to the county coroner. She did not make it through the attack. An autopsy confirmed that she had 36 machete wounds, and that had essentially not only ended her life, but had mutilated her body. But none of the blows was determined to be the singular cause of death because there were so many. She actually died from blood loss, and she was likely still awake and aware of what was happening for most of the attack till she lost enough blood to lose consciousness.
And it wouldn't be long before authorities would have their first lead into who could have possibly done such an awful crime. Across town, just before sunrise, 17-year-old Stephen Spader and his friend, 19-year-old Christopher Gribble, were knocking on the door of their friend Autumn Savoy's house. They were screaming, and they were bragging that they had just murdered two people. And they asked Savoy to help them in getting rid of evidence that they had in their possession. And Savoy agreed. He had actually been asked to participate in the crime earlier in the evening, but he declined. So since he wasn't there for the crime itself, he agreed to help them in covering it up. At 5:30 in the morning, the three teenage boys gathered the bloody clothing that they had wore during the attack, and they also gathered some of the stolen items, and they threw them into the Nashua River. From there, the boys all went back to their homes to sleep through the rest of the night, I would say early morning. But yeah, man, this is like young, I want to say kids, even though they're legally adults, but
yeah.
Like, and this was a breaking and entering to steal stuff, and it turned awful violent.
Yeah, and just to think of the level of violence that happened and what it takes for a human to do that to another person is unfathomable, and especially with, like you said, people this young that are the ones perpetrating the crime. Let's take a step back and learn a little bit more about them and maybe what led them to do this. Stephen Spader was born to a drug-addicted mother, and he was adopted when he was 5 days old. His adoptive parents said that they gave him everything, but he was simply a bad seed. His adoptive mother remembered that Spader was a great kid until middle school, and she said it was like everything changed for him overnight. He went from being polite and cooperative to being defiant, belligerent, and violent. Spader's parents pulled him out of public school and sent him to a private school in hopes of correcting his behavior and that maybe that environment would help to turn him around. Spader instead became more and more involved in the local drug scene and eventually dropped out of school. His parents continued to try, sending Spader to therapy, but nothing helped. He was growing more distant from family and friends, and he was forming his new support system with a group of other social outcasts who were also criminals, and he was looking for somebody that he could model his life after, and unfortunately, he was looking in the wrong places.
I know you said that Stephen's mother was addicted to various drugs. I wonder if Stephen himself was born with drugs in his system. When I became a social worker, that, like, I don't know, it was kind of rare for that to happen. Nowadays, it's very, very, like, frequent that it happens. And I've been saying for years, we need more scientific studies on like what that will cause in adolescents. And I think, I mean, I know this was back in 09, but I feel like we're coming to a time where there's going to be a lot of kids in our population that are going to be going through adolescence who were also born addicted themselves. So I'm interested to see how that plays out. But anyway, this group of kids called themselves the Disciples of Destruction. They included Spader. They also included Christopher Gribble, William Marks, and Quinn Glover. Spader became the ringleader, and as his initiation into this brotherhood, the teenagers had to agree to participate in a home invasion. So during this, they were expected to rob the place and kill everyone inside, no matter what. It didn't matter if they were men, women, or children. Man, I don't know. Home invasions, I feel like, are rare, especially when you know the people are inside. But a home invasion with the intention of killing everyone in the house, like, did they actually, like, were they actually expected to do this? Or were they just kind of under the assumption, like, we're going to say this, but it's never really going
to
happen?
Yeah, somebody will back out. I'll just wait till somebody else decides to back out. I think usually home invasions, the primary goal is to go undetected.
Yeah.
Not this, here.
I mean, yeah, it's crazy. So when Gribble woke up in the morning after the attack, he went to a pawn shop to sell Kimberly's gold jewelry for just $130. Then Gribbles and Spader continued to brag about what they had done in town and just telling everybody what they had done. So, I mean, just right off the bat, you know this is not going to end well. I mean, we know their names, so obviously they're not going to get away with
right.
it. They were visiting their friend Kyle Fenton, and they actually told him very loudly the whole story, and loud enough to where Kyle's mother was downstairs and could hear everything. So as soon as the boys left, she did an adult thing and called the police.
Kudos to Kyle's mom. And, you know, a lot of the cases that we cover end up getting solved because people can't keep their mouths shut. And I'm very thankful for that. This is also why I'm kind of against most conspiracy theories pertaining to several cases, because people can't keep their mouth shut. If there was this big conspiracy, people would be talking. So with Spader and Gribbles telling everybody around town, they were turning right around and calling the police. So the police got multiple calls about these guys bragging about this crime, and they were brought into custody before the end of the day after the murders. Police also brought in 18-year-old Marks and 17-year-old Glover for questioning. Once he was read his rights, Gribble was asked about his involvement in the murders in a recorded police interview. Gribble very calmly told authorities that all he knew about the event was what he saw in the news. Gribble was cool and calm as he was interrogated for hours. And again, when people are underage, oftentimes they crumble in these interrogation situations. He described himself as a gentleman who was so chivalrous that he would never hurt a woman. He also said he was appalled that someone could hurt an 11-year-old like that. When he was told that Jamie survived because they had been bragging that they killed two people, Gribble said that he was thrilled that that girl was able to do that. He continued to double down on his innocence, and he never budged, even when he was told that his partners were talking, which usually is the tipping point, especially for young people being interrogated. But the interrogation did not end there. When we get back, we'll talk about Gribble's further interrogation and how police got to the bottom of this crime.
So the authorities left him alone for a little while, but the interrogation certainly not over. So after some time, Gribbles called the police back into the room and asked if this was the kind of case where the death penalty would be on the table. And the detective said that he didn't know for certain. He said that the state had some pretty strict requirements for the death penalty and that he did not believe that this case would fall under that umbrella. Well, then Gribble asked about the possible prison terms for someone who would be found guilty of this crime. And after a little more thinking, Gribble told the detective to turn the tape recorder back on. I mean, that's wild, right? That's like you're sitting there, you've been interrogated. Then you start asking the detective all these questions about what the sentence could look like.
And for it to happen so quickly after they left him alone, I realize that's a strategy to say, let him live in his own head for a few minutes. But he crumbled pretty quickly after that, especially after he was so strong earlier.
So the detective did so, but first he read him his rights and had him repeat his consent to be recorded. And then he went on to tell a very gruesome story.
Gribble told authorities that his best friend, Stephen Spader, was the mastermind of the entire plot. He said in the days leading up to the murder, Spader and Marks had scouted out locations. They were looking for a secluded property with no neighbors close enough to hear any screams. They found what they were looking for in the Cates residence. Gribble said none of the boys knew who lived in the house, and in fact, they didn't care. They had planned to kill everyone in the house and steal anything they could get their hands on. He said that when the group of Gribble, Spader, Marks, and Glover got to the house, it was locked up tight. Marks, who was the skinniest of the group, said they had him sneak through a narrow basement window to let them in the front door. Marks made it in only to realize that the basement door was also locked. So the boys had to go for plan B. And that's where they removed the AC window unit, got in the house through the window, went and unlocked the basement door, and the rest came in that way. And at this point, they had been at the house for over half an hour before they even started their plan inside the home.
They disabled the lights from the breaker box, and then the group started going from room to room with the flashlights that they had on their cell phones, and they were looking for stuff to steal. But once they made it to the master bedroom, they found what they were looking for, and unfortunately, that was a victim. Spader and Gribble brutally attacked the mother, and Marks watched from the doorway, and Glover couldn't take the horror, and he retreated to the living room. Through this entire story, Gribble was completely emotionless and monotone. He talked about the gurgling noise that came from Kimberly that prompted him to stab her in the throat. He said he was also so upset that he didn't make sure that Jamie was dead, but he said that he wanted to spare the little girl the pain of growing up without a mother. This is crazy.
Did he think that would make him sound endearing instead of even more horrible?
I think so. I think you're right. I think that's why he said that.
So while Gribble is spilling the beans and telling everybody the real story, or at least his side of it, his friend Stephen Spader was across the hall doing the same thing. They told Spader that his friends were talking, shared some details about what they had heard, and then he dropped the innocent act and, again, started sharing the story with zero remorse. He told the story like he was proud of what he accomplished. He was bragging about this crime. The only time he showed any regret was when he talked about being upset with himself for choosing accomplices that would leave a witness behind. While the boys were talking, Gribble's car was being searched, and inside the vehicle, they found an axe, a box of trash bags, a shovel, gloves, rope, camouflage clothing, and a pawn shop receipt dated from that morning. This is pretty much like a murder toolkit. If you see a cart or a buggy full of this at the store, you may want to ask some questions. Spader was remanded to custody and charged with first-degree murder, attempted murder, conspiracy to commit murder, conspiracy to commit burglary, and witness tampering. Spader's fellow inmates told the authorities that he had bragged about the attack on the Cates family over and over while he was in the county jail, emphasizing how many times he hit Kimberly with the machete and really going over and over his role in making that seem like the biggest part.
Again, these are adults, but they are just kids, man. Like, how in the world do you become so evil at such an early age? At trial, Marks, Glover, and Autumn Savoy all testified against Spader. And they did so in exchange for lighter sentences themselves. Because remember, Savoy helped out after the crime by helping destroy all the property. So Glover told the jury that Spader used to tell him that he had fantasies about breaking into a home and attacking the people who lived inside. And not only did he talk about brutally murdering them, he even allegedly fantasized about cooking them and eating their flesh as if what already did happen couldn't get much worse. Thank God we don't think this happened. Glover was the only one who ran to the living room during the attack, and he said that even though he was a fan of horror movies, the reality that he witnessed firsthand was so much worse than what he could have even imagined or expected. But he still went along for what Spader was doing, and he said that this was the evilest thing that this town has ever seen. In November 2010, Spader was found guilty on all counts, and he was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Honestly, if this was a case where the death penalty was given, not going to lose that much sleep about saying that I agree with it, but it wasn't, but he will not spend a day outside of prison, and I'm okay with that. The judge told this kid that he belonged in a cage, and honestly, if that's the worst thing the judge said, then he held back. But there's more to Spader's story, and we'll get back to that in just a moment.
Yeah, let's go back to Glover, and he's the one who kind of panicked and went to the living room. He ended up pleading guilty to burglary, robbery, and conspiracy to commit burglary. So all of the murder charges were wiped clean because he testified against Spader. He was sentenced to 24 to 40 years in prison. His earliest possible release date will be in 2029, and we'll see what happens then. Marks, who's the one who watched from the doorway but allegedly did not participate in the actual violence, pled guilty to conspiracy to commit burglary and conspiracy to commit murder. He was given 30 to 60 years in prison. Autumn Savoy, who was the one that helped them hide evidence, was ordered to serve 5 to 12 years for hindering apprehension and conspiracy. He was paroled in 2012, and as far as we know, since Savoy got out of prison, he's not been in any more trouble.
Christopher Gribble was not the mastermind of this operation, but after hearing him in court, the thought was that he may have even been more terrifying than Spader. In March of 2011, he went before a judge, and the judge said that he, quote, exuded arrogance and evil, end quote. Gribble had been a devout Mormon who actually had planned to become a missionary one day, but then also admitted that he had numerous thoughts of murder, and these thoughts consumed him since he was a child. He also admitted that the person he imagined murdering most often was his own mother. Gribble said his mother was extremely strict and she overly disciplined him. He said that she spanked him too hard, and as a teenager, he said that he felt like it was a form of corporal punishment when his mom would pop the pimples on his back. He also thought it was degrading that his mother made him do chores like vacuuming the house. I mean, am I wrong that, like, should I stop making my children do chores because they may grow up to be murderers?
You should not. It sounds like she's administering fairly normal parental behavior, at least that from what I've heard so far.
In a rather emotionless tone, he said that he wanted to cut pieces off of her and then listen to her scream. He also said that he wondered what it would be like to throw her into a vat of boiling water or smother her in sugar and tie her to a hill of fire ants.
I can't imagine saying these things about my worst enemy, and this guy was saying this about his own mother.
I mean, I don't know what happened at home, but like, what I've heard in this brief summary about his mother, I mean, corporal punishment, you can have your own opinions on that. Popping pimples on his back, that's weird. My mom never did that to me, but I did chores and my mom spanked me. So minus the pimples, maybe that was the thing that
put him over the top. I don't think that's the case. It's just so, yeah, I mean, saying those things about any person is wild to me. Now, come to find out that the Gribbles knew that their son was disturbed, and they had tried to get help for him. They took him to a psychiatrist where Gribble told the professional that he thought he had the potential to become a serial rapist. He also said that he hated his parents and he wanted to see both of them dead. The psychiatrist said it was nothing to worry about. He was just letting off steam. John, you work in social work. I took a lot of therapy classes for a graduate degree. I'm sure that this psychiatrist hears a lot of awful stuff often. Do you think it's desensitizing enough to where they really feel like they can ignore these things? Is saying you want your parents dead a threat to where you have like the duty to report? Those are two very different questions. You can start with the
desensitizing.
Why would they ignore that? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if I heard that, like I'm not desensitized enough to be like, that's actually a really weird way to blow off steam, my man. Like I go for a walk,
yeah.
You know? But yeah, I mean, if they perceived this to be a threat, then yeah, they would have the duty to warn and potentially even have him assessed for like a psychiatric evaluation and hospitalization to try to get him some help that obviously had some really, really bad struggles with mental health.
And it seemed like he could have really used maybe some inpatient care at this time. As he was saying all these things out loud to anybody that would listen, it was like he was untouchable. When he was presented with the possibility of spending decades in prison, he smirked and said the other inmates have no idea who they're messing with. Once Gribble was found guilty of all the same things as Spader, he was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole as well. The judge said that if she had the power, she would have sentenced him to infinity, which is pretty much the same thing as life without the possibility of parole. But I totally get the sentiment there, and not pro-violence, would never promote violence. But I hope those other inmates proved him wrong when he got in there.
Boy, have I got some news for you. So let's start by saying that he appealed his conviction. He said that he had not understood that he had the right to remain silent, but he had been read his rights more than once, and he had verbally acknowledged that he understood. With prison in his future, Gribble tried to make himself look like a poor guy who had been manipulated by law enforcement. But again, if you remember, he initiated the confession on tape, but then tried to pretend like he had been coerced. So his appeal, it was denied.
As it should have been.
So you mentioned maybe the other inmates won't take it easy on this guy. Well, Gribble is not doing well in prison. Because he stabbed a woman and a young girl, he became the target of other inmates. But these guys could back up their big talk.
Yeah, he said they didn't know who they were messing with. Apparently, he didn't know who he was messing with.
Gribble wound up in the special housing unit for his own protection. He was there for several years before being integrated into general population. And when he got into general population, he would eventually be beaten by the other inmates, forcing him to have to go back into isolation. So I want to go on record and say I'm not disappointed this guy's not having a grand old time in jail.
Yeah, we talked pretty much at length on our Patreon episode that came out today about prison justice and what that looks like and kind of where the moral lines are drawn. And here we see, like we talked about there, the violence was against a woman and a child, and that's seen as a lesser than, and you deserve to be dealt with, and they did exactly that. But let's go back to Spader. 2 years after he was convicted, they passed a law in New Hampshire saying that courts can't automatically punish the children the same way as adults without considering the age and other factors. In my opinion, I think this is worded vaguely enough to where everything they did to Spader, or he not did to, everything Spader got, he deserved. He was just a month shy of his 18th birthday at the time of the murder. This meant that he was required to be resentenced and he would be eligible for reduced sentence. We talk about this all the time. Adnan Syed is not being made to go back to prison after his conviction was reinstated. He was a minor when the crime happened. We talk about it with the Lilylid murders. Like, this is a common conversation happening all over the country. Spader tried to tell his attorneys that he wasn't interested in a reduced sentence because he was the most sick and twisted person that you'll ever meet. I think it's pretty rare we meet somebody that's self-aware that says, I don't deserve to get out. But his legal team kept working. They were trying to get him resentenced to potentially get him out on parole at some point, and he didn't even attend the hearing. In a letter to the court, Spader apologized to the Cates family and said he accepted full responsibility for his actions. The state of New Hampshire claimed that Spader lacked remorse and likely would commit more crimes if he ever got out of prison. In her ruling, Judge Jillian Abramson said that she gave no weight to that apology, noting that he had said his main regret was not choosing better co-conspirators, not choosing better murder partners. She called this letter self-serving, disingenuous, and inconsistent with the defendant's true regret. She said the circumstances of these horrific crimes and the extent of the defendant's planning and participating warrant the imposition of life without parole and maximum consecutive sentences. The judge also said the defendant's participation in the attack was integral. Defendant planned the assault, brutally murdered and maimed the victims, and as a captain of this amoral team, intended to savagely kill them. He reveled in his senseless crimes. His sentence of life plus 76 years was upheld, and he's never going to get to see the light of day.
Jamie and her father managed somehow to continue to live in that home where Kimberly was murdered, but they did get a guard dog. They installed an alarm system, and they went on with their lives as best as they could. The community rallied around this family. They've actually since established an annual golf tournament in her name. And the proceeds of the event go toward a scholarship fund to help local students hoping to go to college. They hold this tournament every year on the anniversary of her murder. Jamie has since grown up. She's went to college and she works in the healthcare field, and she's done several interviews. I mean, you can look those up on your own time. There's several over on YouTube and various places. My heart just goes out for this kid who went through something brutal and horrific herself physically, but then mentally has to know that she went, you know, most of her life, if not, and the rest of her life without her mother. And just to know the brutality there, man, I pray that she is somehow overcome mentally what's happened to her.
And such a hero to be able to get through the attack, to call 911, to be able to explain to authorities what had happened so that they could catch the guys. She certainly exceeded every expectation of somebody getting attacked with a machete. So she's a true hero and seems to continue to do that with her work in healthcare. Also feel terrible for the father here who's out of town. Just another case of situations where this could have been stopped beforehand with mental health authorities not acting on information and that kind of thing. There's a case in Michigan of a school shooter whose parents were just convicted as part of his crime.
Yeah.
And I look at situations like this, and I think we're going to see more and more of that moving forward. And had this happened more recently, I think Spader and Gribble's parents may have been held accountable as well.
Possibly. And I mean, I don't know. It's interesting for sure. But man, this case is one of the most brutal things I can remember in a long time. And I mean, it's just so senseless. I mean, oftentimes we see motives, not saying any of them are okay, but we see motives of, you know, sexual desires. We see motives of people just so bitterly angry at each other that they want to kill each other. But here, this is just so senseless. I mean, it is just an initiation into
their made up club. Yeah.
So this one is insane, and I'm glad it's over.
It's terrible. I'm so glad that the appeals were denied, that these guys are going to spend the rest of their lives in prison. And the justice system in this case, while I wish it had been stopped beforehand, the justice system did their job. And as much as it could be, justice was served.
Absolutely. Guys, thank you so much for tuning in each and every week. We appreciate everything that you do to support us. As Jamie mentioned earlier, one of the best things that you could do to help us, which we would really appreciate, is just to leave a rating and a review. If you have a case suggestion, that'd be a great time to put it in there as well.
And we will read it on the air as soon as it shows up there on Apple Podcasts. And we look forward to hearing your case suggestions.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.